Welcome to Curious Campus, a discussion about science, discovery, and culture, brought to you by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I'm your host, Tom Lujan. Today, we have episode 2 of a 3-part series looking at the health and development of children. A significant portion of adults in the United States put on more weight than usual during the pandemic in what is being called by some as the COVID-15. But how did the lockdown affect our kids? Well, 1 in 5 children are considered obese, with significantly higher rates among communities of color. A review of research on childhood obesity after the pandemic hit indicates that what was a problem before COVID-19 is even more so after the last 2 years of altered behaviors. Our guests on today's episode have been researching child obesity for years. Julia Sneathan is a professor and director of the PhD program at the UWM College of Nursing. And Cindy Greenberg is dean of the College of Health and Human Development at California State University, Fullerton. Professors, welcome to today's program. Good to have you all with us.
Hello.
Thank you.
Julia, let's begin with you. How much worse has the childhood obesity problem become now after 2 years of life with COVID?
I think it's important to remember that childhood obesity actually was a global epidemic prior to the 2 years. So we already were in a situation where we had a significant number of children with excess weight. And then when COVID hit, all of a sudden it was actually exacerbated. There was actually a study done by the CDC where they found that between children 2 to 19 years of age, that they had a monthly rate of increase of body mass index that nearly doubled during the COVID-19 pandemic compared with a pre-pandemic period.
That's amazing. That's a pretty big jump, isn't it?
It really is. And one of the things that's really significant, you have to think about, there was even differences in weight gain between different weight categories of children. For example, between March and November of 2020, there is, in this study, the children who are moderately overweight or moderately obese, I should say, gained an average of 1 pound a month. So within 6 months, they had gained 6.1 pounds, which is a lot for a child in that short period of time. But we also found in this study that children with severe obesity were actually gaining about 1.2 pounds a month and had gained about 7.3 pounds within that time frame, which is a very short time frame. And if you want to think about it in comparison, children who were in the normative weight category only gained about 2.7 pounds during the same time frame. So that's a significant increase that we saw amongst the children who already had excess weight to begin with. So, you know, one of the concerns is that we were trying to stop or modify some of that weight gain. And instead, what happened during COVID is we actually saw a significant increase.
Cindy, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. You and Julie authored a report on childhood obesity while the country was still in lockdown back in 2020. So tell us a little bit about what effect the specific conditions of the COVID pandemic had on childhood obesity.
Mm-hmm. Great question. And with the quarantines that we already had in place, the schools shut down, children were pretty much confined to their homes. And in the first few months of the lockdowns, many people were even afraid to go out of their homes. They just stayed inside, had food delivered or whatever. And so they just really hunkered down. And based on our work with childhood obesity, we were concerned about many aspects associated with the lockdown and the impact of the children's behaviors that can affect weight. So there were several things that we thought about. The children weren't able to run around on a playground with other children every day at school, and that contributed to more sedentary behavior. They had increased rates of sedentary behavior, especially younger children. Children who were from under-resourced communities might not live in a neighborhood where it's safe to play and run around outside. So where someone who has a backyard or something might be able to go out in the backyard, they couldn't even go out in the backyard or the front yard. So that was a concern. Children were also in front of screens, you know, TV, video, well, cameras, whatever.
And some of that because they had to be, because school was being taught
Correct.
Through the screens, right?
Yes, because they were attending school virtually and or to keep the child busy while the parents were home working. So kept them entertained and quiet. So both attending school and depending on the child. So they were definitely in front of screens a lot more than they were at school, in person school. So, and while they're home, in addition to these factors, children had very easy access to refrigerators, to the snack drawer while they were home. So, anecdotally, many parents have said they noticed that they had to go to the store much more frequently to keep the food stocked and that the children were snacking all the time. So that easy access to food, whereas at school, you usually don't have a snack drawer. And while the schools did their best to minimize the impact and during lockdowns and they set up drive-by pickups and such, many children, which was a huge concern for us, many children lost access to free lunches and to free breakfasts. And before the pandemic in 2019, the National School Lunch Program provided about almost 30 million, I think it was 29.6 million, free or low-cost lunches every day. And the School Nutrition Association analyzed some USDA data, and they showed that school meal programs served nearly 30% fewer meals to students in the first 12 months of the pandemic. So that is a definite reduction. And the concern we had, too, is that school nurses are the only nutritious food that some children get for the day.
Yeah, that's
otherwise,
great.
They get fast food. So the school lunches are required to meet certain standards and be nutritious. And so there's some research done by a nonprofit agency, Food Research and Action Center, and they found that participation in some of the federally funded childcare or the school meals programs is associated with significantly lower BMI among young, low-income children. And they estimate that receiving a free or reduced cost school lunch reduces obesity rates by at least 17%. So that's significant.
So Julie, you and Cindy saw this situation unfolding that affected so many people, I mean, across the country, mm-hmm. or I would suspect across the world. Mm-hmm. How did you decide to do a research project around this?
So we actually are very fortunate. We actually are all, everybody who worked on this project are members of the American Academy of Nursing, and we're on the Child, Adolescent, and Expert panel. And so when we started talking about amongst the expert panel, what are some major issues with kids that we need to be thinking about? Childhood obesity certainly came to be one of our top priorities. And within our group, there were several of us, quite a few of us actually around the country, who've been conducting research on childhood obesity. And we decided we would work together. It's kind of nice to be able to work with people who you've seen their name in print and now you're getting to work with them. It's been pretty awesome, actually. So we went ahead and started meeting. And one of the few nice things about the pandemic is we had Zoom. And so we were able to virtually meet from around the country. We would gather every week and start talking about, you know, what's going on? What are the struggles? And, you know, certainly we consider the obesity epidemic an epidemic. But now we have this pandemic, and what's happening when these kids are, you know, those two things are kind of colliding. And I think one of the concerns we had was, you know, certainly as adults, we were experiencing all of a sudden we had easy access to the fridge and to food, and all of a sudden our workout places are closed down, and how do we handle that? And so we really started considering that in relation to children and how that might be impacting children. And one of the things, you know, as Cindy kind of had already mentioned, is the fact that all of a sudden children are home all day. they're getting bored. And when they're bored, well, they certainly have some virtual time, but they're getting tired of that as well. And so to grab for food, to grab for a snack, and then grab for another snack. And I actually had, similar to what Cindy said, is a lot of my friends were saying, we can't keep the place stocked because they're eating so much. But at the, you know, the other thing is, I don't think we realize how much stress children have experienced during the pandemic. And one of the ways people do alleviate stress is through eating. So, you know, there's a combination there, but we also have to think about what are other ways that children, you know, take action to relieve stress. And it's usually by taking action, such as play, exercise, physical activities. And all of a sudden, that wasn't possible. They couldn't run out inside. And I know that some were even talking about they're in apartment complexes. There's no place to go play. I mean, there's no place to get out. And I also think even though they had virtual access, they didn't have that face-to-face socialization that is also an important element for potentially alleviating or relieving stress. And so we had all this stress potentially and not really an effective way to address it. So I do think it just made sense to us as we talked about it that we were fully expecting to see weight gain amongst children across the board, and we were very concerned for those who had excess weight, whether it be moderate or severe weight at that point in time.
And Cindy, that it's critical that you were paying attention to this, because being overweight at any time is not good, but we were talking about a period in during the COVID pandemic when weight was a factor on outcome in a COVID case, right?
Definitely. Definitely. Because it was pretty early in the pandemic where it became evident from the numbers that obesity in adults increased the risk for hospitalization, increased the risk to be put on a ventilator, the need for mechanical ventilation, and increased the mortality rates, increased the risk of death due to COVID. So, and initially, actually, during the time we were writing this as well, or looking into it, the initial variants of COVID appeared to cause less disease in children than it did in adults. But we were already concerned about the rising rates of childhood overweight and obesity. And then seeing the information about increased risk of negative outcomes with COVID in adults, in overweight and obese adults, we were interested in looking into the relationship between this further and how that affected children and their potential outcomes.
Cindy, could you talk a little bit more about the role that stress plays in putting on weight?
The body reacts to most any stressful situation with what's called the fight or flight response. And many people have heard of that. And during this response, the body secretes hormones such as cortisol and adrenaline. And those hormones increase the blood pressure, they increase the heart rate, and they release sugar from the reserves in the body. So that all of this can be for the sugar, so it can be used to power the muscles and brains, so that it can react to the stress, but also increasing the blood pressure and heart rate, your body's ready to respond. And short-term stress can decrease the appetite, but if it's an ongoing stress, then typically your appetite increases because you're using body reserves, you're using sugar, et cetera. And then the elevated cortisol levels, one of those hormones, the cortisol levels, it can cause cravings for sweet, sugary foods and fatty foods. And a lot of people talk about how they eat more junk food when they're stressed. And commonly you hear that.
And Julie, when that happens, it triggers even more problems in the body, right?
Yeah, it does actually. You know, the stress hormones, as you know, was mentioned, they really cause inflammation in the body. But when there's a constant inflammation, it actually becomes chronic inflammation. And chronic inflammation is really important to consider because it affects the body's energy regulatory system, which really impacts how efficiently you metabolize food. And so if you're having chronic inflammation and your energy regulatory system is damaged, you may not be metabolizing food the way someone who has a healthy energy regulatory system. And so thus you're going to see excess weight gain as well. You know, but I think besides, you know, the stress, there's other factors we have to consider when we think about obesity. Certainly genetics plays a part in it. So for example, we've done studies where we have two children in the same home. They're eating the same diet. They're in somewhat of a controlled situation at their age. They're doing the same activities. They have the same parents, and one child's overweight and one child's not. So then we think, okay, what's going on? Is it an external environmental factor we have to consider, or is it something genetic? And I think in some ways, the last, 10, 15 years, we've kind of, overlooked some of that genetic component, but I think it's more real than we think and something we need to at least think about. But the other thing I think of within a family, if there's got two different children with two different experiences, what's going on with that child with the excess weight? Are they under extra stress that we're not aware of? Are they experiencing or having reactions to experiences that may be contributing to that stress or that hyperinflammation going on? So we really have to look at that, and each child's unique and different, and see what's specifically going on with that child and if there's specific triggers for that child that maybe the other siblings in the family aren't experiencing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Julie brings up an excellent point. And we've already said being overweight increases inflammation in the body and adipose tissue, the fat tissue. It's an active endocrine organ, and it plays a critical role in maintaining energy balance. So when the excess nutrients enter those cells that store fat, they start a cellular stress response that results in sustained cortisol production and the chronic inflammation. And a decreased immune response then results from chronic inflammation, and that's made worse. It's exacerbated by stress. And because obesity decreases an individual's immune response, and in this case, we're talking children, so it puts the child at increased risk of adverse outcomes if they get COVID, which in itself is an inflammatory disease. So another concern is that for groups that have been economically or socially marginalized, who might not have access to resources, access to safe environments, access to stable housing, that stress then remains chronically elevated, the body's responding and the hormones and everything else. So it makes it even more difficult to maintain a healthy weight. So stress exacerbates that.
This is Curious Campus, a discussion about science, discovery, and culture, brought to you by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I'm your host, Tom Lujak, and joining us today are Julie Sneathan, a professor and director of the PhD program at the UWM College of Nursing, and Cindy Greenberg, dean of the College of Health and Human Development at California State University, Fullerton. Cindy, we always hear that processed foods aren't very good for you. How do they contribute to obesity, particularly when you're talking about kids?
That's a great question. And it used to be that Americans ate differently. Before industrialization, many families grew their own vegetables. They raised their livestock. They hunted. They fished. They were out there getting their own food. And food that's in natural form, like they were eating, the fresh vegetables, the fresh fruit, the whole grains, eggs, meat, they're what we call whole foods. And related to that, people were also out working on the farm, and they were burning calories that they consumed. So they didn't really have to worry about storing that fat because they were burning it all off. And with then industrialization, people started eating more processed foods. So going back to your question, processed foods have been modified from their original forms. They have been stripped of nutrients such as vitamins, minerals, fiber. So they're no longer really the untouched whole foods. They've been processed. And the processing also adds sugars. They add salt, fats, chemicals, other additives to make the both the shelf life longer and the appearance and the taste more appealing so that it can stay on the shelf, but people also buy that food. And so I always have a joke around here that, you know, you have maybe unhealthy foods and I go, yeah, sugar and fat taste good. So anyway, in addition to processed foods being more calorie dense, Americans are just eating more as well. So there was a Pew Research study that the average American consumed about 23% more in 2010 than they did in 1970.
Wow.
So that's almost a 0.25% increase.
So Julie, part of the problem is that the label might say that it looks healthy. It says oatmeal, but if the oatmeal has a lot of sugar in it, not necessarily as good as the label would suggest.
That is absolutely true. And I think that there's so much misinformation in advertising and certainly in labels of products. And it says, oh, it's healthy, it's whole wheat. And then you look in and say, well, no, it's not really. So I think one of the things that we've done a lot over the years in our research with children and their families is really teaching them how to read labels and really look to see what's inside. What are the additives, specifically added sugars and salts, because that can contribute to an unhealthy diet. And also making sure that they're not, for example, we want whole grains. If you're having rice instead of white rice, brown rice, because it's not been refined and you have a lot of the roughage and fiber that you actually need to be healthy that's in those other products that are really important to consider.
You know, you've talked a lot about how stress can be a factor that contributes to obesity. And certainly, you know, the stress levels were off the chart for all of us. One of the other things that I recall during the height of the pandemic was I wasn't sleeping very well. And my wife, who's, you know, is up every few hours just because she's such a light sleeper, was really in a bad shape during that time. What's the link or what's the connection between how much sleep you get and how much weight you might put on, Julie?
So I think that's a really good point because actually there's been a lot of studies where they've been looking to see if there's a cause and effect, you know, inadequate sleep and excess weight. They have found an association between not getting enough hours sleep and weight gain. And certainly with the weight gain, there's an increased risk of developing type 2 diabetes. And while there's no real definitive explanation for this association, there have been some thoughts about it that somehow lack of sleep affects the body weight across infancy and childhood because, you know, when you don't get enough sleep, the hormones that regulate appetite and food intake actually can be altered. And so that can be a problematic. And I think that, you know, one of the things people don't realize, even like with adolescents, they actually need more sleep than, say, an adult. So for a typical adolescent, 9, 9.5, 10 hours might be the average sleep that they really need. Even though we know a lot of times adolescents are getting significantly less sleep than they really do need. You know, and compare that with an adult who may need 7 to 8 hours of sleep. And I think a lot of times parents and other adults around the adolescents think that, well, I only need 7 or 8, so you really only need 7 or 8, which isn't true. I actually know some school systems that have changed their starting times to be a little bit later in the hopes that adolescents would get additional sleep. So when they came to school, they would actually be energized and focused and able to learn. And I'm not sure that that really accomplished it, but I'm sure that the adolescents appreciated having extra time to sleep in. I think that it's also important to consider if you aren't getting enough sleep, what happens when we don't sleep? Oh, we have more time to go in and help ourselves to whatever's available in the kitchen, or I'm bored, I'm going to watch some more TV. And honestly, it actually contributes to an unhealthy environment within your body when that's happening.
So you have this unvirtuous cycle that kicks in. So I play this game with myself. There are times where I know, you know, I've got a lot to do and I'm just going to squeeze as much in. And the end result at the end of the day is less time for sleep. But I think I'll make up for it later. I'm going to cheat myself tonight and maybe tomorrow night, but I'll be done mm-hmm. with that project and then I'll move on. So what is, can kids do the same thing? Can they cheat it and cheat the system, if you will? And if they can't, what impact does it have on their younger bodies? Cindy?
Well, you know, it makes me laugh because it's similar to exercise. You know, exercise isn't stored, only fat is. And that's a similar thing. You really don't store sleep. Your brain heals itself. It there's a lot going on during sleep where probably your brain is more active than during the day. And so there's a lot of restoration going on in the body during sleep. And you really can't just store up on sleep on the weekends. So you really should aim for, as a healthy habit, aim for consistent sleep habits that allow for enough sleep.
Does it hurt an adolescent more than it hurts an adult to short circuit the sleep cycle to cut back?
Well, you know, I guess I think because the adolescents need more sleep, if they're cutting it short, they're actually doing with less than what they really, really need. Whereas if an adult gets only 6 hours a night versus an adolescent gets 6 hours a night, when they are needed more to function to their optimal level, they are being more significantly impacted, I think, at that point.
I've got to ask, how did you first get interested in working in pediatrics, working with younger people as part of your career? Cindy, what was the trigger for you?
I don't know at the time how I knew about nursing, maybe pictures or whatever, but when I was four, my mom said, I told her I want to be a baby nurse, and I really never thought about doing anything else. So I guess in that sense, especially seeing students nowadays having so many different majors and careers, I just sort of went on my straight and narrow path. And so I did that. And growing up in Chicago, I did my undergraduate work at Rush University in Chicago. And I worked there in the pediatric intensive care unit for a while. And then I went back to get my master's from the University of Colorado with a focus on care of the acutely ill child. And then when I moved out to California and got my doctorate, I got that at the University of San Diego. And then I've worked at several universities just as I precepted new nurses and realized I really liked teaching. And that's one way to help the next, help propagate the knowledge in the next generation. And so worked at Cal State Long Beach, now working at Cal State Fullerton. And so at Fullerton, I was working with colleagues promoting healthy lifestyles in healthy lifestyles to prevent disease. And the community around our campus does have a large Hispanic population. And so many adults had common diseases that are commonly are seen in Hispanics. So diabetes, hypertension, obesity, and many children were overweight and obese. So as a team, we decided to focus on obesity, since obesity can lead to chronic conditions such as the hypertension and diabetes that we see. So given my background, it was a multidisciplinary team. And so I added sort of the child and family perspective. And then as Julie and I were working together, we both were members of the Society of Pediatric Nursing. We've been members of other professional associations. And so we've worked on a lot of committees together and have a lot of shared interests. So that's how we we both, you know, have talked about childhood obesity. And so we've worked on several projects together.
Julie, how about you? Were you, like Cindy, always, did you always know you were going to be a nurse, or how did you find your way into this profession?
No, I actually was raised on the University of Missouri Columbia campus. Literally, I was raised in faculty housing. My dad was a professor there. And so I always thought I was going to be a teacher because my dad was a teacher, and I thought that's just what you do. And then when I was 10 or 11, I had a couple days in the hospital, and I got to know nurses. And all of a sudden, I found myself very intrigued. I was a candy striper, and I, you know, did a lot of volunteer work at the hospitals as well. And so, but what really, I think, got me, I thought, you know, I could see nursing, but I'm like, I really like teaching. I really like nursing. And when I was 16, my sister actually, at her pinning ceremony for her nursing program, there was a dean from Iowa. Her name was Evelyn Barrett, and she talked about the top nurses in the country, the top 1% are PhD prepared. And so I, in my 16-year-old mind, thought, if I get that PhD, I'll be an excellent floor nurse, and I'll know everything there is to know about nursing. Like, everything is what I will know. And so I was kind of driven at that point because I also realized that I could combine teaching and nursing together, and was really focused on that. But I actually, when I actually started working in the hospital as a nurse's aide and then as a nurse, I just loved the babies. I would go in there an hour before clinical to rock the babies. Literally, in those days, the babies were all in the nursery and you could go rock them. And my faculty member would come on the floor at 7. We were supposed to be there. And she goes, oh, Julie's rocking the babies again. So, and I loved that. So I loved labor and delivery. I love postpartum. But I also started working in a pediatric unit. Oh, my gosh. I love the children. So I was like really conflicted. Do I want to do peds or OB? So I actually have done pretty evenly clinically both. But as I continue to work and conduct research, I found myself working in a kidney transplant dialysis unit. And I ended up doing my research. My master's thesis was on children with end-stage renal disease. And then when I actually became a dialysis transplant nurse coordinator at a children's hospital in Kansas City, I found that once the children went from dialysis, where they were like, we were literally putting candy on their food trays and they were eating, you know, hardly anything, just trying to get calories in, they would get transplanted. And all of a sudden, within 6 months, it would have gained 100 pounds. And we're like, oh my gosh. And so then our problems became, you know, hypertension related to weight, not because of the kidney. We're, you know, things like high cholesterol related to weight. And so some of the issues, you know, like type 2 diabetes, you know, we were then developing, the children were. So then it becomes, wait a minute, what's going on and how do we address this major issue in the kids post-transplant? And so I think that's when I really started getting interested in looking at obesity.
I want to come back to the topic we started with, which again is weight gain during COVID. What advice would you give parents who maybe themselves have put on that COVID-15, or especially the parents with kids who have added a lot of weight during these last 2 years? What should they do at this point to try to get back to the pre-COVID norm? Cindy?
Well, I suppose making the choice and the decision to try to adopt healthier habits is the first step. Nobody can tell you to do it. And, oh, yeah, that you can think that it's a good idea, but until you really internalize it and think, I'm going to do something, then, you know, it's some external voice telling you that. So when parents decide to adopt healthier food habits and introduce new foods, one thing they need to understand is that it takes a while before children feel familiar with a new food choice. So a child needs to taste a new food 11 to 15 times before they become comfortable with it. And that's a lot of exposure. Parents don't realize that. And, you know, when you're feeding your children every day, you don't realize, oh, it seems like we have had this before. What's up? So anyway, it's good to tell parents about that a child needs to taste a new food several times.
So don't give up. Don't give up on giving the healthier option.
Correct. I'm sorry.
Don't give up on offering the healthier option just because the first time you offered it, the kid says, don't like it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yes. And parents shouldn't force a child to eat an entire serving of a new food. They should give them one bite to taste it and then allow the child to say, no, thank you. And at our house, we call that the no thank you bite. And so children are also more open if they see that food, if they have that texture of the food, et cetera. Children are also more open to tasting new foods if they help prepare the foods. So involving them in the meal preparation is a good way to help them be willing, more willing to try new foods. And I do recognize that many don't have the time, the desire, the resources to do this, but children are also very open to trying new foods that they've grown themselves.
Yeah. So Julie, some parents may be tempted to say to their children, look, you put on weight, I put on weight, we have to get our act together here. Not good advice just to tell a young person that they have to stop eating, right? I mean, they're not looking at the problem the same way that the parent is.
You know, I think talking about weight and how you need to lose weight is actually gets pretty exhausting and demoralizing to both children and their parents. I would suggest really focusing, we really need to get healthy. What can we do proactively to get healthy? So when you start talking about health instead of weight, I actually think you're more likely to get people on board with that. And certainly when the family needs to get healthy, it's not just the child with excess weight or the parent with excess weight. It's the whole family. Even if you're thin, that doesn't mean you're healthy. So really approaching it as a family approach and a family change. So let's all think about, all right, what are some food items in the house that we really like, that we'd really like to have? Take the kids shopping with you. Okay, let's see how many different vegetables. Let's get something that's green and orange and white and, you know, purple to put in the basket for food. What are some berries or fruit that the children really like that they would be willing to eat? Be really creative when you think about what kind of meal preparation. Are the kids going to be involved in cutting up the food or organizing meals so they're ready to go for the week? You know, okay, so this is Monday through Friday's meals. We just throw them in the crock pot in the morning and we're ready to go to have a healthy meal in the evening. So really focusing on that. But also, what can you do to change, you know, your exercise, your physical activity? What can you do to be healthy? Like, all right, instead of sitting down after meal and watching TV, let's go for a walk. The family can go for a walk. All right, I've had one mother told me that she would turn on the music and they would do scarf dancing and they would hop around the room with these scarves. What a great idea in the winter when you can't go outside and there's no place to go. You know, I've also seen mothers, fathers, children walking the malls in the wintertime when there's no place else to go, and let's just go walk. Certainly children may have some energy level that mom and dad don't have or vice versa, but what can we do together? Take the dogs for a walk. I mean, whatever it is that you do, something that you're doing together, but getting them engaged and being part of that process is really what's important. I do think that children eat what their parents eat. And so if the parents are only eating unhealthy food items, that's what the kids are going to want to eat. But if the parents, I mean, the kids see the parents eating the carrots or the salad as opposed to potato chips or French fries, they're going to eat it too. That's really important that it be, that the health be a focus for everybody within the family.
Julie, Cindy, fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for taking time to talk about this challenge that that so many of us face, just one of the challenges that come as a result of having experienced COVID the last 2 years. Best of luck as you continue your good work in this area.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, that's today's program. Our guests have been Julie Sneathan, professor at UWM's College of Nursing, and Cindy Greenberg, the dean of the College of Health and Human Development at California State University in Fullerton. Curious Campus is produced by Gennaro Armas and Laura Otto. Our engineer is Jason Reavy, and I'm your host, Tom Lujak. If you enjoyed our program, please consider subscribing on your favorite podcast app.